All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll them!
Welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is film buff online editor-in-chief, Rich Dries.
And seated across the microphone from me is film buff online contributing editor, Natasha Bogutsky. How's it going, Natasha?
Really liking the editor part.
That's just my way of tricking you into writing more for the site.
I thought the whole idea of being an editor means you get to do less work for the same amount.
No. And first of all, the amount of money we're all getting is the same. But no, just more any responsibilities actually for you.
Ouch.
I kid.
And speaking of responsibility, TCM doesn't seem to want to take responsibility for frickin' Filmstruck.
I don't know if it's TCM's fault. I think the command to cancel that service came down on high from Warner's Digital Media Services, or whatever that exact company is that it's part of.
Well, I already signed the petition.
So did I. Last I checked, though, that petition had... let's take a half step back here just to bring everybody up to date in case you somehow missed the news that the awesome streaming service Filmstruck is being shut down on November 29th. Filmstruck is until for the next 3 weeks or so, is a great service that holds the Criterion Collection as well as a lot of film that is available in the Warner Home Video library that they make available for streaming, including lots of MGM stuff, Warner Brothers stuff, a few other things here and there that Warner Home Video has picked up over the years. And basically, it was kind of curated by the folks at TCM. And so you would get, you know, Stars of the Month, similar collections to what you would see on Turner Classics. And for some of those who have cut the cable, that made a great alternative to TCM. And unfortunately, there wasn't enough of us subscribing on a monthly basis.
Well, I'm hoping that maybe we might be able to still save it.
It would be nice. I have a feeling this was a cold, calculated business decision, and it's not going to happen. I don't want to be the buzzkill here, but last I looked, there was only 26,000 people who signed the petition, and Filmstruck only had 100,000 subscribers. So you're not even getting a quarter of who is subscribing signing this petition.
We're up to 32.
Okay. Still, it's less than a third.
But it's gaining traction as Guillermo del Toro, Ryan Johnson, Edgar Wright, and Bill Hader have put it out there even to try to further the cause.
Okay. Well, we'll see. I really would like this to be a win for the good guys. The good guys being us and
Come
not
on.
Corporate America.
Come on. The good guys help save your precious Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
That's true.
And that's true. Lucifer. So,
there was a possibility. It was a good spring when cancellations and then pickups at other networks happened for a couple of shows. I will admit that. Yes. So, we'll keep our fingers crossed. However, I would say this is kind of a reinforcement of the idea that you really should own physical media. You really need to own your own movie collection. It's great to have access to a lot of films like you get through Filmstruck. It's great that Filmstruck offers some films that would not be economically viable for a home video company to put out on disc. The audience for them is too small, so they can make those available. And that's sort of the theory also behind the Warner Archive and their make the disc on demand. But if you really want to watch the Maltese Falcon at any time, you can't depend on a Netflix or a Filmstruck or a whomever to have it available for you.
I haven't been able to count on Netflix for classic films in a very long time.
Netflix for classic films is terrible right now.
Right now, their classic films only go back as far as the 80s.
I know. And granted, that's when I started to become a film nerd, and I would consider many of those films classics. However, if I really have an hankering to watch How to Marry a Millionaire from the 50s.
Great movie.
Yeah. Or
Double Indemnity.
Double Indemnity. Or The Maltese Falcon. Or The Thin Man. And I'm naming films that are actually on my shelf. But if I wasn't me...
Most of them are on Filmstruck, though.
That's true. And most of them are on Filmstruck.
Plus, blaxploitation films, foreign films,
mm-hmm.
a lot of Lars von Trier, Guillermo del Toro, Wes Anderson, all their films have gone Criterion, which means that they would be available almost exclusively through Filmstruck streaming service.
And honestly, Criterion discs are a bit of an investment. They're, you know, $30 to $40 usually.
At least. Seven Samurai runs $50 on DVD. Hell, if you want Blu-ray, you're going to be paying $60 to $70.
True. And a lot of these films, you hear are classics, you hear they're great films, but honestly, that's a lot of money to invest if on a blind buy if you haven't seen that film before. And I understand that. Even with the 50% off sales you get at Barnes & Noble. So,
which happened once, twice a year.
Yeah. So I love having Criterion's films available on a streaming service where I can preview them and say, you know what, I'm not sure about this film. And then you sit down, you watch it, and you decide, you know what, I'm glad I saw it, but I don't need to own it. Or I'm glad I saw it, I'm going right out and buying that son of a gun. Or I'm going to wait till the next Criterion flash sale on their website or what have you. It's vital. I mean, it's very important to have, you know, a streaming service to make this stuff available for you. But again, just, you know, with Filmstruck getting shut down and possibly not getting that decision reversed, I just kind of look over at the three sets of shelving that I have here in my home and say, thank God I have all these movies available to me and I don't have to depend on the corporate whim of somebody to be able to watch these movies.
In fact, I just pulled, you have my Filmstruck queue list.
Yes, basically.
He wrote down my entire Filmstruck queue list because there's no way in hell I'm going to be able to get to all, what was it, 69 movies or
69,
something?
68 movies you have on that thing in the next 3 weeks. No.
Yes. So
not even if you quit your job tomorrow, you're not gonna be able to do it.
No, not unless I'm watching like 3-4 movies a day, which is absolutely possible.
Which doesn't sound like a bad way to spend the next 3 weeks. But
and looking at the majority of them, mm-hmm. it's about half and half. So half of them you happen to own on physical media.
Yeah. So
the other half you don't. So I will have to try to hunt these down. And most mm-hmm. of them, if not almost all of them, are Criterion.
Yep. You know, and I'm certainly happy to help you out with, you know, catching you up on films you've never seen. So, you know, as I've always said, my library is your library here. So
as is mine, but I highly doubt you'll dip into mine because we're pretty much the same at this point.
Where we overlap, we overlap.
Yeah, we really overlap. Except you do have a small pile of my movies just sitting here on the coffee table.
I am still working on screeners from last week from Philadelphia Film Festival. And then next week...
which you never sent me.
For New York. Whoops. And next week for... Doc New York, Doc NYC Fest, which is a 5-day film festival for documentaries. And I have about 6 movies for that I need to watch, which I'm anxious to get to. It's just finding the time. And that's also my big problem. I always overcommit to projects. You know, I was like, hey, it's not enough that I run a film website. Let's add some television content to it now. Let's add a podcast. Let's add... us working on a short film together. Let's add me working on somebody else's short film on the weekends for the past couple of weeks.
And you're writing a new one.
And let's add me trying to find time to write some stuff too. Oh yeah, and you got to actually watch a couple of movies every now and then. Yeah. I,
and you worry about me overworking myself.
And I have a 40-hour week boring day job.
I'm right there with you. I sat there for a majority of today trying to figure out, as I have written a noir film, trying to figure out what kind of hairstyle I want my main femme fatale to be wearing. That was 2 hours of my day.
Well, I'm sure your producer would tell you to not worry about that right now, because pre-production for that film is June.
I know. I would rather get it out of the way while I'm waiting on my writer to come back with the script for our next
film. I'm sure he's working very diligently at it.
Yeah, I somehow doubt that.
Thanks a lot. Now, right before we started to record, a bit of news dropped, and I think we want to touch on it really quickly, just because when I told it to you, your eyes lit right up. And that is Disney and Lucasfilm have announced that there will be a second live-action Star Wars television series on their new streaming service, which debuts next year, called Disney Plus. And that new series is going to center on Cassian Andor, the character played by Diego Luna in Rogue One.
I'll tune in.
I'm excited about it. I mean, this is an era, obviously, before the original trilogy that it's going to be set in. We sort of know where it ends, his story ends, but how he gets there should be an interesting journey. And granted, we've seen some of this area explored already on Star Wars Rebels, but I think this is going to be a little bit darker and more morally gray.
I hope so.
It should be interesting.
That's one of the things I liked about Rogue One. It wasn't straightforward. There was a lot of depth, even to, you know, the minor characters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you and I both know I'm not a big fan of how it ended.
I know. Oh, boy, do I know.
But I do have a lot to say about that film and how they developed their characters. And that being said, I do look forward to, I hope it's more about, you know, his backstory, obviously. Mm-hmm. It has to be about his backstory.
Oh, yeah.
But it would be nice to know how he got there.
True. What's the spoiler deadline on Rogue One at this point? I think everybody who's seen it has seen it. We're kind of dancing around it a little bit.
I was dancing around it.
Well, you know, trying not to say how Rogue One ends. Although at this point, if you're a Star Wars fan and you haven't bothered to see Rogue One at this point, are you really a Star Wars fan? But yeah, I mean, it should be fun. I think this will make an interesting companion piece to The Mandalorian, which is currently in production. We don't know who's making this show, who's writing it, who's directing it, or anything outside of the fact that Diego Luna is coming back. So hopefully in the next couple of days, weeks, and months to come, we'll start getting that information. My guess is we'll probably see this thing in 2020.
I mean, we have Jon Favreau's show coming, right?
Yeah, The Mandalorian. The first episode's probably going to be there the moment the streaming service becomes available. Because that's why people are, like, tuning in or, you know, going to be getting this thing. Parents are going to want to get the Disney service so they can stream Disney movies and cartoons and stuff like that for their kids. But there's a significant amount of people who are going to be there day one going, where's my new Star Wars? And boom, that's what they're going to get.
Well, we shall see.
Indeed we shall. And we'll be right back in just a few moments with a look at a couple of trailers that dropped this week.
Legend tells of a lost species, a link between man and beast. For centuries, he's lived in hiding, but at long last, he's reaching out and ready to be found.
It's still there. Excuse me. Hi.
You can speak.
Yes. And, I write as well. My penmanship isn't great, but, you know, opposable thumbs and fat fingers, you know.
Meet Mr. Link.
You know, like, missing Link. Ah! Wait, I don't get it. Mama pajama
rolled out of bed. A creature of enormous stature. 8 feet tall. 650 pounds.
More like, 630 pounds. You know, it's the hair that makes me look heavier, I think. It's a little deceptive. It can be frustrating.
He's a link to our past.
Oh.
A connection to our present.
Oh.
And a bridge to the future.
Oh. Wait a second. I said, oh, like I knew what you were talking about, but I don't. Well, I'm on
my way. This spring,
on the other side of the world,
are my cousins. Can you take me there?
I know the secret ways through the mountains.
Is it hot in here?
By all means, crack open the window.
No.
Oh, that's better.
The search for his kind.
I'll bring back proof of the greatest discovery of the century.
Will become an adventure of mythical proportions.
You have killed my grandmother!
Quick, quick, quick! Someone should give her the kiss of life!
You're the man for the job. How's my breath?
He is the missing link.
Throw me out of the pit.
I think it might be a little too heavy.
Nonsense. Now, give it all you've got.
Oh, it's hard to know whose fault that was. Let's do it again.
Why does he look like a cross between Bigfoot and the bear in the Big Blue House?
Good question. Well, he is a Bigfoot, Sasquatch, missing link, abominable snowman thing-ish.
Are you getting Bear in the Big Blue House vibes? Because I certainly am.
I've never seen Bear in the Big Blue House.
What? You lived through the 90s. It's like not seeing an episode of Teletubbies.
Didn't do that either.
What is wrong with you? Wait.
I was out drinking through the all of the 90s.
You must have been tired of them.
But this is Missing Link. It stars Hugh Jackman and Zach Galifianakis.
And Zoe Saldana and Timothy Oliphant.
Mm-hmm. So. And it's from Laika Studios, the wonderful stop-motion animation folks who gave us Kubo and the Two Strings, which is one of my contenders for one of the best movies of that year. Also Coraline and a few other things. now, I'm kind of lukewarm on this, actually. I mean, I've liked his stuff in the past, but this is kind of like not quite sold on this yet.
It's very simple. It seems like a very simple plot, very simple animation. It's a lot lighter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've never seen Coraline. I'm very well aware of its plot.
Okay.
And I know how dark that thing is, and I will admit,
mm-hmm.
Ari Hatcher's button-eyed The Other Mother gave me nightmares as a kid, and is probably the reason why I still haven't watched it. Kubo, I haven't seen, but I am also very aware of its plot, and it seemed very intricate. This just seems boring.
There doesn't seem to be a villain here, any kind of antagonist. It's just,
it's a journey.
Hey, I'm gonna get you. Yeah, it's a road trip, maybe.
Yeah, and... Zach Galifianakis, what a surprise.
I mean, obviously, it's too early to judge the entire movie based on, you know, one trailer that's, you know, 2.5 minutes long or whatever.
But, oh, no, it is not.
Well,
we have done it several times.
That's
Robin
true.
Hood.
That's true. Robin Hood looks Yes, I'll admit. Robin Hood looks like it's a movie directed by somebody who really wishes they were Guy Ritchie.
A Girl in the Spider's Web.
Mm-hmm. But we'll probably still wind up going to see those movies and this.
You're on your own. I love Claire Foy, and I won't even sit through that.
Wow. So I'm hoping another trailer will come along before this comes out next year and really kind of give me a reason to want to go see it instead of just having to see it because I'll go see it kind of a thing.
Not to twist your arm there.
Yeah, I know.
Laika, you will see my movie.
You will see the movie? And you will like it.
And the next one up was on our list to get to at Tribeca, and unfortunately we missed it. Alex Pettifer, the actor who did Magic Mike, Alex mm-hmm. Rider, and a few others, took his hand at directing with co-star Jennifer Morrison, and it takes place in Pennsylvania.
Ooh-hoo.
So let's see if we notice any landmarks.
Let's see if we enjoy the trailer for Backroad.
Mommy, I missed you.
It's been a long time. Is everything okay at home?
Everything's not okay.
You are are the master of every situation. True.
The taxes? They're due in 2 weeks. We don't have any of it.
What are you talking about?
I can't afford it. Which work don't you understand?
You're not going to college or doing anything meaningful with your life.
Want to come in for a minute?
Is there anything I can do to help?
Did she want to make you feel better?
Where were you? We had a crisis.
You're not really the way a guy's supposed to be.
You said you were going to call me. Why haven't you called me?
What you are doing is sacrificing yourself for someone.
You know much about guns, Harley.
I want to make a call.
We're not done yet.
Don't touch me! You're disgusting!
Tell me the truth. You own me.
I didn't leave anyone on purpose.
I know who you are. You don't belong here. But I can't help you if you won't let me.
I know the truth.
Why did you really come here?
So my question to you is, why did you kill her?
Well, that certainly is a different vibe than we got from the Missing Link trailer now, isn't it?
Yeah. And I really wish that we had caught this at Tribeca.
Yeah, I'm sitting there watching this thinking, man, this does look pretty good.
Yeah.
And I'm glad it got some distribution so we can, you know, finally catch up with this thing. Not sure it's going to make my best of the year list, though, which is still in flux, with two titles that I saw at Tribeca very prominently
in
the mix.
And I know which ones you're talking about.
We'll get to that in a few months when we get to our best of the year episode.
But what a cast. I mean, I knew Alex Pettifer. I mm-hmm. knew Jennifer Morrison. I didn't realize that Juliette Lewis and Chris Cooper were... No, that wasn't Chris Cooper. That was Robert Patrick.
That was Robert Patrick. Okay.
Yeah. I didn't realize that those two were in this. He definitely went out there and got himself some good people to work with.
Definitely. Now, did he direct this as well? Or
yeah, it's okay. His directorial debut.
Directorial debut. Fantastic.
There was a lot of those at Tribeca this year.
Yes, there was.
wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Nudge.
If you don't know what we're talking about, go back and listen to our Tribeca wrap-up episode.
And how we just enthusiastically gushed over
don't
Karen
say
Gunn's
it.
The party's just beginning.
I was trying to say... Okay. Go back and listen to our Tribeca wrap-up episode. Thanks a lot, Rich.
You're welcome. So that looks definitely like one I am going to be on the lookout for once it opens.
I have no idea when it's opening.
I believe it's, at this point, if they're releasing the trailer now, probably 2019.
Actually, this will be opening December 7th, which coincidentally is the same day one of our favorite Tribeca films, also a directorial debut, is going to be released by Orchard.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So what we're saying is...
Double feature?
Double feature. Double feature indeed. Debut double feature. There you go. Directorial debut double feature.
And that's when you drop the audio from Abbott and Costello in here. Sounds like a double feature. I just made your night,
boy.
Didn't I?
Yes, that's a deep cut. Thank you.
You're welcome. I honest to God, I really do wish that I had caught this film because it looks really interesting. Unlike the film that I sort of caught this week.
Oh, come on. Don't make me sad. You're going to do this, aren't you?
I am going to do this.
Damn it.
I sat down and decided to try one of Rich's favorite films, Flash Gordon, this week.
You have no love of life. If you don't like this film, I'm sorry.
I walked out of it halfway through. I'm so sorry. It was horrible. I mean, it was campy. I understand that that's what they were going for. I'm just... Oh, my God. She wakes him up with a kiss. I'm okay with that. Because technically, it wasn't the kiss that revived him back to life. But it was the whole, I like you. I won't look. And we see him starting to get changed in a mirror. And she goes, I really like you. And I'm like, oh, that's it. I'm done. I'm out of here. Bye.
You were not an 11-year-old boy who saw Ornella Moody slink across a screen and
said, believe me, she is hot. She is hot. The moment I saw her for the first time with Deep Roy.
Yes, I love that.
By the way, Fellini?
Yes.
They couldn't have made a better joke.
Well.
He was supposed to direct it, wasn't he? Originally?
I think at one point Fellini had been approached, but. Really? Were we ever really going to see that happen? No.
To be honest, I'm glad.
It's Dino De Laurentiis, you know, is the producer. So, you know, gets to name check his friends in there if he wants.
Yeah, good point. But the best thing about it was Timothy Dalton and Brian Blessed. I'm sorry. Even Max von Sydow couldn't hold a torch. He was shit in that movie.
I hold on. First of all, I will say that the supporting characters are all better than Flash and Dale. There's no question there. You know, Melody Anderson and Sam Jones do a fine job, but their characters are written kind of blandly because he's the good guy hero and she's the gosh darn virginal Dale Arden, although not really virginal, but for purposes of the
story.
She's
the damsel in distress.
Yeah, she's the damsel in distress. She kicks a little ass on her own.
Maybe I didn't get that far yet. We've got the damsel in distress. We have the good guy. We have the tyrannical emperor. We have his slut daughter. In a Me Too society, this film would not fly.
Fair enough. I think Max von Sydow as Ming is delightfully evil and fun.
I've seen him do better performances as evil.
True, but he's just enjoying being evil here. And I think that's very much key for the character. Ming is a sadist. He delights in all of this. He delights in tormenting entire worlds and pitting kingdoms against each other for his own fucked up amusement. And that's what we get from Max von Sydow's performance here.
I just wanted more Timothy Dalton. The scene with the first scene that he had with, what was her name, Aura?
Mm-hmm.
You lying bitch. And I went, okay, any character that he plays and says that to a woman deserves my respect because God knows she deserves it. I didn't trust her from the moment I saw her.
What I like about Timothy Dalton and Brian Blessed is Timothy Dalton is like just so Shakespearean here. He's just pulling all his Royal Shakespeare Company training to kind of give this like regalness and tough guy.
He seemed like macho-ness Errol Flynn.
Bit of Errol Flynn in there to Baron. Meanwhile,
Brian Blessed's just like,
I am here. I've got a pair of funky wings on and I'm going to just laugh myself silly through this movie.
And he's like a Viking.
Yeah, he's a Viking. And he's hammy, he's over the top, delightfully so. And these two styles of performance should not work together.
But they do.
But they do, exactly. And that's what's great about this movie. Beyond also this beautiful set design, the practical special effects, the practical model work for all the rockets. Come on, I don't know if you got this part. War Rocket Ajax going through the red clouds and everything moving through. It's so beautiful.
The last thing I saw was the initiation and Flash being given as a gift to Timothy Dalton's character.
With Richard O'Brien there, too.
Yeah, I noticed Richard O'Brien, of course. I'm about to name drop, and no one's going to know who I'm talking about, Darren.
Mm-hmm.
That was the reason you really love this movie. The moment I saw his name on the list, I went, oh, now I know why you
like
it.
No. Actually, Richard O'Brien's fine. I would have liked more. But I think all the characters are great in this, with the exception of Flash and Dale. They're kind of like...
Top Hall. When I saw Top Hall, I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah, he's great.
He was fun. He was actually fun. But overall... Did not care for this movie. As I said, I walked out.
The tone of it is very much you either get it or you don't. And I'm not going to give you too much grease.
Like The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai?
Yeah. Again, I like things that have very odd tones. That, Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah. Don't go there.
I love Big Trouble in Little China.
So do I.
And you know that. I know you do. But, you know, that's also a very oddball tonal movie.
But it takes itself more seriously.
A bit more. I think that's John Carter for you. yeah, you know, excuse me, John Carpenter, the director for you, but
I can handle levels of camp if the rest of the story seems genuine.
Mm-hmm.
This didn't feel genuine to me at all. It felt like I was watching the Batman TV show, which is fun in its own right, but there's only so much of it I can take.
And that's funny because I love Flash Gordon, and I can see your parallel to the 1960s Batman series. And I do not like the Batman series from 1960s. I watched it as a kid, and I was like, I just never really vibed in on the jokiness of it. Maybe because I was, you know, in the 70s, I'm already reading Batman comics and the stuff being written by Denny O'Neil and illustrated by Jim Aparo and everything was a lot more the Dark Knight Detective. It wasn't quite the grittiness that we got from Frank Miller with The Dark Knight Returns and how that kind of spun the character off in a darker direction. But it wasn't jibing with what I was reading as a kid at the time. So I just didn't like the Adam West Batman. I've gone back and watched it now, and I kind of appreciate it for what it was doing. But at the time, I was just like, man, I can't be bothered. But come on. What did you think of the music, though, in Flash Gordon?
Well, it's Queen.
Mm-hmm.
I need we say more?
True.
I mean, I'm a Highlander fan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that's all. I mean, when I first saw Highlander, I really didn't even notice Queen did the soundtrack. I just liked the film as it is. As I got older, oh, yeah, that's Queen. In fact, Queen is what made me watch Flash Gordon.
Okay.
I don't think there was enough there to get me. But I was surprised that they didn't mention it in what we are about to talk about next, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Higher.
Can you go a bit higher?
If I go any higher, only dogs will hear me.
Try.
Galileo! Galileo Figaro!
Higher.
Jesus, how many more Galileos do you want?
One more.
Galileo! One more.
Galileo! Galileo Figaro! Again. Go on, roll the track.
Galileo! Who even is Galileo? Are we done?
That's it. He loves you.
At one point in Bohemian Rhapsody, the new biopic charting the rise of the 1970s and 80s rock group Queen and its magnetic lead singer Freddie Mercury, Freddie points out that the band's new album can sound like anything, because that's the strength of the group. And he's right. No two Queen songs sound the same. But they all are unmistakably songs written and performed by Queen. Getting the story of the band to the big screen is most likely itself a story fit for its own movie, as directors and attached talent came and went from the project over several years. And that's not discounting the shenanigans that were ongoing during the film's production that culminated in director Bryan Singer's firing with just 2 weeks left of filming. So, Natasha.
Yes?
Was the hardship that surviving Queen members Brian May and Roger Taylor went through to get this film made worthy of the band's musical output? Or is Bohemian Rhapsody just another cookie-cutter pop music biopic?
Good question. I'd say both.
Interesting.
That was not the answer you were expecting.
No, actually, I sort of kind of wasn't.
What were you expecting?
I know when we first talked about this after I saw this on Tuesday and you had previously seen it, that you seemed much higher on the film than I was.
Oh, I'm higher on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's Queen.
Yes.
I don't know a single person in this fucking world who doesn't like Queen.
And you wouldn't want to know a person who doesn't like Queen, really.
I mean, even some of my the people I know who are exclusively rap fans, who go to like the hip hop clubs and go dancing and everything. The moment We Will Rock You comes on, they're stomping their feet, they're clapping their hands. I don't know a single person who doesn't like Queen.
Fair enough.
The strength of how this band has influenced generations was apparent from when I was sitting in the theater and when the end credits rolled, everyone started applauding.
Same here at my showing. People applauded at the end. And I was kind of like, wow, you just saw a bunch of recreations of rock concerts. Is that sort of like the, oh, I just saw a rock performance, I should clap kind of impulse hardwired into certain people's heads who go to live music a lot? I don't know.
No, it has nothing to do with the rock concerts. It has to do with the energy. And it felt this film did have that energy.
I will give you that with the caveat of this film had that energy during the performances.
Yeah.
When we actually got to the narrative portions of the movie.
You see, I disagree there.
Okay.
I do feel that there were parts in which this film lagged. Tonally, time-wise, it lagged, even performance-wise. But there are also moments where it feels like it needs to be slower. For all the performances and all the concerts that we see in it, it needs to take a moment and it needs to slow down and it needs to savor in a moment or two. Like, for example, there's a scene in which after Freddie is leaving a hospital after receiving his diagnosis, he was 18, 19? The boy?
Yes.
Is sitting on a bench and recognizes him. Doesn't say anything except, Ayo. And there is a very long pause into which Freddy just turns his head and responds back at him and then walks out the door.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great moment.
It is.
But yeah, it did feel a little rushed all the way through it.
Well, this film jumps time like crazy.
Well, it falls prey to the usual problems you'll see in biopics, especially about musical acts, where they compress things, they kind of move events around. You see them in concert performing Fat Bottom Girls 2.5-3 years before the song was written. you know, stuff like that. And honestly, the most egregious thing that they do, and I sort of see it for, you know, a narrative purpose, Freddie Mercury didn't get his AIDS diagnosis until 2 years after they performed at Live Aid. Not before. The band wasn't really broken up. Freddie, yes, went off and did a solo album, but Brian May had already done a solo album. It wasn't a big deal for them. So they needed this thing to kind of break up the band and then get them back together for Live Aid. And part of that has to be Freddie telling them his diagnosis. And then they go on. It seemed to add an element of drama that probably wasn't needed. Let's just see Freddie and the band perform perhaps one of the greatest singular rock performances of all time, just performing it. We don't need this whole extra, they're all rallying around him because, you know, they know he's dying because he has AIDS now. And this is, you know, the peak of, you know, his life or everything. That was kind of an artificiality layer added on. That wasn't really needed. Because honestly, even without that, when I was watching the Live Aid stuff, and I was just watching the power of that performance, I was tearing up.
Oh, so was I.
I told you, I
teared up.
I know you said there was a couple of times you teared up in this movie, and I just said, nothing because I wanted to kind of tell you this right here that, I was just sitting there and, a couple of tears rolling down the side of my face because it was amazing. It was beautiful. It was the culmination of his life. He didn't have the death sentence that AIDS was at the time, and in a way still is. He didn't have that hanging over his head yet. And I think that would have been a dramatic irony if they had let it play the way it normally, it actually played out in real life. We didn't need that diagnosis moved forward in time to kind of give that scene some poignancy.
May I play devil's advocate for a moment?
Sure.
How many years did you spend as a rock journalist?
Oh boy. I would say
rough estimate
8 to 10 years, somewhere in there.
All right. You probably paid more attention to the history of some rock bands than other people have. I didn't know any of that until I was sitting here.
Okay.
And for me, now knowing it, yeah, it was more for a narrative point. But from a narrative point, it works.
Oh, yeah, it does. I mean, I can sit there. I sat there and I watched every little piece of Queen history that got moved around. I could sit there and say to myself, yes, I understand why they're doing this.
I don't like them for doing it.
From a storytelling standpoint, I can see the wheels and the gears moving on this machine. And I sort of didn't like that because, I don't know, it's because I understand the mechanism of how this stuff works or the mechanisms of what they're trying to do.
Would you have rathered a story that told the history of the band without actually having a story, or would you rather there be one?
I think, you know, without turning it into, you know, a dramatical version of, you know, VH1's Behind the Music, you could still tell this band's story, keep it more factual, and actually, you know, leave in more things that I feel kind of got pulled out. Yes, Freddie was a hard partier, but so was the rest of the band. They really made it seem like
Freddie was the only one.
Yeah, Freddie was the only one. And the other three guys, you know, were just fine, upstanding young men who
would go home
after a gig or whatever.
Yeah, but that was a big jump in time.
True. And Brian May and Roger Taylor were consulting producers on this, which means basically they had veto power over any script. And that's why this movie took so long to get made. Previous directors wanted to make this R and focus more on the lifestyle and how fame impacted Freddie's life. And this film does that to an extent, but I feel like a lot of the rough edges are polished off on this thing.
Yeah, because it
could have been a much more interesting film. That's why Sacha Baron Cohen, who was originally at one point was attached to play Freddie, wanted to do. He's like, this needs to be an R-rated movie because we need to deal with some of this stuff. And I think it can be explored in a, you know, thematic and dramatical way.
Well, here's the question.
And I don't think this movie ever achieves what it could have been.
Do you think maybe they did it because they don't want it to mess with not only the legacy of Freddie Mercury, but their own legacies and the legacy of the band itself?
I think everybody is familiar with the legacy of Freddie and his life and his lifestyle. It's been written about over and over again.
There's
been biographies and stuff like that.
There's a difference between it being written and then seeing someone who is portraying, I almost said pretending, but portraying this person come to life, mm-hmm, and watching those acts on screen. There is a huge difference in that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure, you know.
Because then you're ingraining, this character did this, even if it is just written for the story.
Mm-hmm.
It is now ingrained in an audience's brain that this person did this.
Yeah, I will definitely grant you there is a big difference between knowing something about someone and seeing it or having it confirmed in some way and how that can affect you.
And that's something that I find as an actor, as a director, as a writer, and as an audience member,
mm-hmm,
people don't understand is the difference between fantasy and reality. And they don't understand that even if you're portraying a character, you're not them. They're not you. And what you're portraying up there, even if it's in a biopic, might not necessarily be the truth. Because things can get changed. Lines are written for a script,
mm-hmm,
that may have never been said the real person.
True. I mean, the EMI record company executive, is a complete amalgam of like three different people. That person with the bad ginger beard did not exist. So, you know, they kind of had to, like, take a couple of different things, a couple of different people who had different qualms about Queen's music and, you know, following up albums and stuff like that, and kind of just distill them down into one character to get that information across. Mm-hmm. And I don't mind that, because that's, you know, kind of true to the story for that. Tangentially, can we all just give them a big round of applause for having Wayne's World star Mike Myers...
A huge fucking laugh, play, by the way.
Play the guy who says
Bohemian Rhapsody, that'll never be a hit.
Kids will never sit in their car and bang their heads to this song.
That got people laughing so fucking hard in the theater.
Really? Because I was the only one who laughed at that.
Really?
Full theater, I was the only one who laughed. And I gave a good hearty ha and dead silence. And I had to explain it to the people I was with afterwards why I was laughing.
Oh no.
Yeah, I was disappointed. No. I looked around the theater like, really, you all suck.
Our theater understood it and they were howling.
Much better audience than I was stuck with. Lucky you.
I know.
The fact that
you had to explain it, I'm so sorry.
But some of the other things kind of get moved around for maybe expediency's sake, you know, like the thing where Freddie pulls the microphone stand apart because it's easier to use.
I did kind of find that funny.
That happened when he was singing in another band before he joined up with the other guys. And he was in another band before he joined up with these other guys. He was just like...
Yeah, but it made sense story-wise for it to be there.
To put it there, yeah. Because he's like, that whole moment is about crystallizing him as a performer.
Yeah.
From the beginning.
And it's a very shaky moment of, can he do this? Can he not do this?
Yeah. Oh, so dramatically,
shit,
it kind of works.
South. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait. Oh. Yeah. That's what you get from that scene.
And I would say, like every biopic, don't accept this movie as gospel about what happened to Queen. Mm-mm. You know, obviously, Brian May has things, his own reputation. He's probably trying to...
Protect
a little bit. And yeah, so maybe the movie's not going to talk about how he met his wife at one of these crazy wild parties that Freddie would throw. It could just mention that he has a wife later on.
I can count on my hands the amount of people I know who have met their significant others at parties. It's a commonality.
True.
But how old is Brian May at this point?
I don't know. 70s? Late 60s.
At this point, he's not worried about... He's worried about what his grandchildren are going to think of him, okay? He's not worried.
Hey, Grandpa Brian, can you tell us about the orgies Uncle Freddie used to throw? Because basically that's what they were, let's face it.
Oh, my face just went beet fucking red.
Oh, boy, did it, ladies and gentlemen. I understand the urge to polish off those rough edges. I understand the urge, you know, from a dramatical standpoint, from a narrative standpoint, to combine events and stuff like that. It's just that it kind of made the whole thing seem very conventional. And Queen, if
was
anything,
was
but,
not conventional.
Yeah, they were all about bucking conventions and throwing conventions in the garbage and doing their own thing. And I really wish we had seen more of that in the movie. Mm.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, it even starts off with, okay, you know, one of my favorite comedies of the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years is Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox
story.
Which
I have not seen.
Okay, the movie starts off with a scene where,
I know where you're going.
Right before a concert, Dewey Cox is kind of like hand up against the wall, looking down. One of the stage managers is, Mr. Cox, it's time to go on. And Tim Meadows, who has played Dewey's, one of Dewey's band members for like his entire career, goes, hold on. Before Dewey plays, he has to think about everything that happened in his life. You know, they make it sound like real important, like so deep and everything. And they're goofing on like stuff that you've seen in
Walk the Line
and in other movies. And they literally start Bohemian Rhapsody backstage at Live Aid with Freddie Mercury thinking, you know, getting ready and being reflective before going out on stage. And I sat there and go, I can't believe they're actually starting this movie with a scene that has already been parodied, you know, in a comedy about these types of movies. It seems like it's like, okay, it was just a bad way to start the film.
Good point. I'd like to say that this film is going to last.
Oh, yeah. People-
but it's not. It's going to be forgotten in the next year.
I don't think so. I think people are going to really like it because of the performances, because of the performance the recreations energy. Yeah. And the energy there.
And that's
the
and
rest of it is so disposable. But
and that's why it will be forgotten.
I don't think
how
it'll be
long
part
did
of the
Walk the Line stick around for?
Yeah, that's true. And that had some great performances in there. There was energy in those.
There was energy. There was great performances. There was Oscars.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God,
and
that's
it
right.
Was gone.
That's okay. True. Yeah, I think, you know, it's going to do well. People are going to go see it.
When it comes to music biopics, they don't last.
No.
Walk the Line is the only one I can think of from the past 20 years that has gained any sort of recognition that stayed around. I mean, I have the soundtrack to it, and I can tell you right now I haven't listened to it in like 3 years, three, 4 years.
And it, even Walk the Line, you know, with its Oscar contentions and everything, I don't see it coming up too often in conversation about film when you're discussing film now. You know, it's not used as a reference point to anything unless you're talking about Walk Hard and what it's parodying. Hmm. And then you go, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, well, that thing in Walk the Line.
So as much as I'd like to say that it's going to be some sort of sensation, that people are going to love it, they love it now.
Yeah. It's
in
doing
a year,
great
no one's going to remember it. No one's going to mm-hmm. have it on their shelf, well, unless it's us big movie buffs. But, you know, you're not going to – it's going to be in the $5 bin. Well, maybe not five, but more like 10. But still, it's going to be a cheap buy.
In about 3 years.
Sooner.
Sooner? Wow.
Ouch. I'm going to say sooner. Target will have it for 13 probably next Christmas, if not 10.
You're probably right. And that's a shame because, I mean, it's an interesting story, just told in the most uninteresting way possible.
Yeah. And that's the only problem that I really had with it. I loved Rami Malek.
He's fantastic for what the script gives him.
He made me believe.
Mm-hmm.
What's her name? Lucy Boynton. I mean, I've loved her since Ballet Shoes with Emma Watson. You've loved her since Sing Street.
Yes. Sing Street's a movie I would rather, a movie about a band, a fictional band that I would rather watch again.
Over than Bohemian Rhapsody. I've seen only like the first 15 minutes of Sing Street, and I can easily say I would rather watch that than this.
Mm-hmm.
But
I would go back and maybe watch the Live Aid concert again.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I'd go back and watch the We Will Rock You segment again. Because mm-hmm. I will admit, that had me going. I turned around. I was looking around the theater because I wanted to see how the audience was reacting to this movie. Because I knew how I was reacting. I wanted to see how everyone else was. I could hear stomping from the back fucking row. I'm down by the bar.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I mean, yeah,
so
people kind of got in the mood.
It.
Yeah. And I like those moments where we see, like, Brian May going, okay, I got this idea to involve the audience. I was like, oh, okay, great. We're going to talk about the music now. And when they're having the argument and Roger just kind of plucks out the bass line that becomes Another One Bites the Dust. And they all stop and go, wait a minute. What was that?
Nice shred. Like,
they were like,
we can't do disco.
I liked those moments in the thing.
My favorite was the whole montage of how they made Bohemian Rhapsody. Can
That's
we go
fantastic.
Higher?
Fantastic.
My balls are in my throat.
That whole sequence was fantastic. And then they cap it off by showing all the negative reviews for the album. And we don't get to see how the band reacts to that. We just kind of keep moving on. I mean, yeah, granted, in 2018, we know that The Night at the Opera is a classic Queen album. We know that Bohemian Rhapsody is probably one of their greatest songs, and it's an amazing piece. It's not just an amazing piece of rock music, it's an amazing piece of music, period.
Yes.
And
everyone I know knows the lyrics to that fucking song. They don't know what some of the lyrics mean, but they know every single fucking word, and we can sing it
as
a group.
True. But, you know, you get to this point, it's like, here's they're making the song, they're really proud of it, and the critics are kind of lukewarm at best about it, and moving on. We don't get a reaction from the band about all of that work being greeted so indifferently at first. And just story-wise, we really needed that.
I'm okay with not having it, though. Why? Because it shows, I mean, they went through all that fight about this is going to be our single. Not I love my car.
Mm-hmm.
Not this, not that. It's going to be this one. And the critics pan it.
Mm-hmm.
The EMI guy pans it so much so that they walk out and throw a brick through his window. Sawed off your wanka. They are certain that's going to be their biggest success. We don't see the reaction to it.
Exactly.
Only to find out at the end, they were right.
Well, we know they're right. But I want to just see the band react and going, surely that had to cause like some moments of doubt or some anger or confusion. Something.
I'm sure it did. But for story-wise, I don't care about that. Why? Because it goes to show that they still believed in it. So much so that it turns out they were right.
Oh, yeah.
They moved on. They did other things, but they always still had faith.
And that's a George Michael song.
I don't want to see them doubt their faith in that.
I think dramatically, though, that would have worked, or at least seen their reaction, or, you know, just them going, you know what, screw the critics, and then doubling down on their beliefs. Something. I think, you know, when you're building that, and then you're especially when you're throwing the stuff in with the critic response, you have to pay that off. And I don't think the movie pays that moment off.
We're gonna. This is another one we're gonna fight over, like Atonement and Moulin Rouge and anything by Baz Luhrmann, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is gonna be one of our eternal agree to disagree movies.
Yes, I will enjoy it for what it was.
And if we,
it's not
if
going
we
in my collection.
Probably not mine either. I would probably watch it again at some point.
Oh yeah, just if to it kind hits of streaming, you know, streaming. I'll probably turn it on for like a late night. I want to have some, you know, fun, maybe sing along, mm-hmm. you know, kind of film. But I'm not gonna go out and spend my money on this movie to have it gather dust on my shelf and I never pull it out to watch it.
Fair enough. And again, I would probably go back after a little while and check it out just to see if my opinion on this still holds up, if I see some more problems or if I'm more forgiving of the problems I've already seen. So
you were just upset, like I said, that
there was no mention of Flash Gordon in this movie.
It wasn't audibly mentioned. It wasn't physically mentioned. It was tonally mentioned.
I don't agree with you on that.
I do agree with myself.
Of course you do. Somebody's got to.
Yeah, someone's got to. When they are moving from city to city to city in America for all these concerts for their big first tour, we see Los Angeles, New York, Atlanta, Rio, and how they transition from concert to concert. How they light up the words is almost like the opening of Flash Gordon,
which
timeline wise doesn't make sense.
No, because this, you know, this is happening for the band around what, 74, 75, 76,
yeah.
And Flash Gordon was 1980, and they recorded released in December of 1980, so they recorded that music probably over the summer of 1980. I sort of see what you're saying, but part of me feels like it's just more of a 70s motif. You know, kind of a 70s stylistic thing that we saw a lot in the 70s versus, you know, an intentional nod and a wink towards Flash Gordon.
I mean, it might have been.
There's a moment where they could have dropped a mention of that in, too. Like when Freddie is complaining that he wants to go off and record that solo album.
I want to do something different.
Exactly. And, you know, Brian could have turned around and go,
dude, we just scored a science fiction film.
Exactly. And that's all you needed. And it wasn't there, and it was.
Granted, there would be people out there going, "Which one?"
Well, yeah, and then you know the Highlander fans and the Flash Gordon fans could have a brawl in the parking lot later.
And the Highlander fans, because we believe in the Scott, would whoop your ass.
Would have the hidden sword up in the pipes. Yes, we know. But they did have one Highlander mention, though.
Again, not so much a mention, mm-hmm. more of a tone. They dropped the song off the soundtrack, what was it, Who Wants to Live Forever,
mm-hmm.
at the perfect fucking moment.
Oh, yeah,
film.
That's a song that
did you tear
you
up?
Can't Maybe.
You can be honest. Did you?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, everyone did in our theater, including me.
Again, that's a song he wrote before his diagnosis, if I'm remembering the timeline correctly. So, you know, there's that dramatic irony to it when they do use it. And
it just happens to be when he receives his diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And was he looking in a mirror at that point?
I believe so.
Yeah, it's a self-reflection moment, no pun intended.
No. Gee, something an incredible, obvious bit of symbolism from a Bryan Singer film.
And using that song just made that moment so much more powerful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is a great moment, you know, and obviously, even without me slagging on Bryan Singer for it, for the mirror thing,
say what you need to say, but I want to...
It really works.
It does. And speaking of moments, there was one that you said that you audibly wowed to. I need to know what that
was. Oh, it was during the Live Aid performance. There's that one camera move where we start off under the piano and we see Freddie tapping his feet. Mm-hmm. And then the camera rushes forward towards him. It goes between the pedals of the piano, under the piano bench, and over to Brian May playing guitar in the We Will Rock You part.
How the hell do you think they did that?
CG.
Really?
Oh, most likely. But
damn. I was hoping it might have been a practical camera effect on a...
That we could do at some point?
not on a or dolly similar. Or maybe a track or maybe it was a focal pull.
No. The camera just, you know, zooms forward.
Okay.
Because once it clears underneath the piano bench, it kind of...
Goes up.
You know, arcs up and then to Brian May playing, you know, the solo.
Shit.
And yeah, it was just like, I'll sit there and I will go, huh. You know, I'll kind of like, you know, nod my head when I see something I really like, or, you know, go, you know, kind of give it the De Niro smirk thing, which you can't see on a podcast. But
oh, I know what you're talking about.
Because you've seen me do it.
I've seen Robert De Niro do it.
He does it better than me, oddly enough. But when that obviously. when that move happened, I really went, whoa.
You did Keanu Reeves.
I kind of Keanu. Yes. I was really impressed by it. It just kind of like floored me there. I was like, wow, that was amazing. And there was like that and one other really nice transition I liked. That, you know, I really made a mental note at the end of a concert where they're playing Fat Bottom Girls. You know, you're looking at the stage and a dun, 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 dun. You know, it's the end of the song. And this huge wash of white lights come on the stage and, you know, wash out the screen, basically, as the band starts, or excuse me, as the fans in the audience go, wah! And it cuts to a white, kind of an overblown lit background and a plane landing down on a runway.
So
and,
that the fans became
the
jets,
fans became
didn't
the roar of the jets and everything.
That's
and,
awesome.
And it all, you know, it was like a, you know, white splash and then fade out from the white to this. And it looked amazing. I was like, that is a great transition. And maybe great filmmaking shouldn't call attention to itself all the time, but those two moments really did. And those were some great, you know, just great visual pieces that
Bryan Singer's?
Bryan Singer's, Dexter Fletcher, the gentleman who came in to do the last 2 weeks of directing, or Bryan Singer's DP, who was also ghost directing stuff when Bryan Singer couldn't be bothered to be on set. I don't know who's responsible for that, but hat tip to whoever it was.
And I do have one final question.
Yes.
Before we decide to wrap up for this week.
Mm-hmm.
Who or what would you blame for the reason this film did not work as it should have?
It's going to sound slightly shitty, but ultimately the blame comes down to the people who had the veto power on how this story is told, and that's the other members of Queen.
All right. You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
Yep, Brian May and Roger Taylor, they're the ones who had the ultimate veto power on how this story was going to be told. So they're the ones who are kind of responsible for how it was. There's no getting around it. I'm sorry. I enjoy them as musicians, but maybe as film producers,
maybe not so much.
Maybe not so much. No, I hate the thought of we'd have to wait for them to die before we get an honest movie about Queen's and Freddie Mercury's life. But maybe we have to. Maybe it won't be another 20 years until someone's able to do that. And if 20 years from now somebody does make a much more honest Freddie Mercury story, from what I've read about his life, and I think what they hint at, but don't get into too much, because I don't think this movie really gives much of Freddie's interior life at all. I think you should probably call that movie Somebody to Love.
They did utilize that.
They used the song, but I think ultimately...
No, the theme of that song.
Yeah, but I think ultimately when you're talking about Freddie Mercury's life, I think he was trying to find somebody to love. And obviously that song is... probably
the most honest,
but it also feels like from a filmmaking standpoint, it's too on the nose about him. So I don't know if you would use that or not. And I think, though, that about wraps us up for this week.
Indeed, it does. Remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com, and we are now available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So either use the link in the show notes post or head directly there, search and hit subscribe. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review because that always helps us connect with new listeners. We'll be back next week with more news analysis and a look at, Fantastic Beasts 2, The Crimes of Grindelwald.
And that's all here on the Big Picture Podcast.